Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, and rating. We love that. Letting people know about the IMRO award winning show 2025. Very rarely polish my own tiara, but there you go. Yes, we won the IMRO Award. If you'd like to listen back to the award-winning entry, am I saying award-winning too many times? I've been accused of that. You can do that on the News Talk app, powered by GoLED. All right, enough of that. On this week's program, we're going to talk about morning sickness. And my wife had it pretty bad. We had morning sickness on our honeymoon, which is rather unfortunate because we were in the Maldives. And pretty much the, not only food, but the best food you can eat there is fish, right? Because it's an island and Dara couldn't have any fish. And we ate in a place that was free drinks and she couldn't drink. And so I went diving, but then of course she couldn't dive. So anyway, I had a great time. I had a wonderful time on our honeymoon. But my poor wife was riddled with this. But I'm sure she can now look back on that time with great appreciation, because it turns out that morning sickness is really important. We'll find out why in a few minutes' time. If you would like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, sciencenewstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of those comments at the end of the program. Some interesting comments this week. First, though, as always, it's time to look back at the week's science news. We're joined by Dr. Laura Hayes from Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story, I suppose, should start off with the Nobel, Shane. It wasn't technically this week, right? But something we wanted to talk about because it's got a cool name. Pretty much the only reason I want to talk about it. Hermione's handbag. Oh. What is that?
Hermione's handbag refers to an article that was written in The Guardian to explain the science of the Chemistry Nobel Prize. It was very clever. It's how do you make something called a metal organic framework sound interesting, right? It is pretty interesting. But they went with the Hermione handbag angle, which I think is very cool. And in the book and in the film, Hermione was able to store a huge amount of things in a tiny handbag.
Right.
And they say there's an analogy here with the new material. There kind of is and there kind of isn't, but we'll go with it, right? So the Nobel Prizes were all awarded last week. Everyone focused on peace and whether Donald Trump would get it or not. But for us scientists, we were more interested in chemistry, physics and physiology. And the chemistry one went for materials called MOFs, metal organic frameworks, which are extremely porous. So what they do is they take metal ions, right, things like copper, and they are able to join them together in structures using organic linkers, so kind of other kind of molecules to link them all together, such that they have a structure that's predominantly empty. It's incredibly porous. It's very, very lightweight. And you're able to use these materials to soak things up because they have a very, very large internal surface area. And therefore, you can use them to capture carbon dioxide, which is a good thing, right? They can also be used to capture water as a big sponge. And you can use them to filter water. And you can change the chemistry of how they're made in order to have very specific sorts of stickiness. So you can make it preferentially sticky for water or carbon dioxide, etc. And the reason it can suck those things up is that relative to the size of these big porous materials, molecules like carbon dioxide and water are tiny. So there are tiny little things that can get into it, kind of stick onto the walls, and then the material is able to be kind of removed and you can take the material with you. So it's a handbag in that way.
That's a terrible analogy. It doesn't make any sense.
The handbag, thing. Yeah, the handbag seems to imply that you're able to create space, which you can't. So this, like,
it's bad.
So
let's it's get bad. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. But but the concept itself is very useful. But has it been applied in in practical science already?
Yes, it has. So like the work here, there's awarded to three scientists who are spread across the world working on it in different ways. But yes, this is being used, right? So this idea is that they're talking about it as the wonder material of the 21st century, right? These so-called MOFs, metal organic frameworks, because of their stickiness and their versatility. And you can make them in different flavors to do different things. But yes, they are being used. But of course, as always, when you talk about these sort of types of fundamental science, it's about scaling. It's about putting them into mass production such that you could soak up enough water or enough carbon dioxide for it to be useful.
Yeah.
And for the production of the material in the first place not to be kind of, you know, counterproductive. So it doesn't cost so much energy to make it that its versatility becomes almost redundant.
Right. Sounds like this decade's graphene, essentially.
Yeah. And well,
because maybe. We're now starting to see lots of things.
Absolutely.
In the graphene, yeah. Okay. Our second story, Laura, has to do with flavors and where we smell and taste in the brains. I always find this fascinating, and my kids still can't get their head around it, the idea that we taste in the brain.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of crazy too. And I guess we've known this, right? If you have a head cold and you're trying to eat something and you can't smell, it tastes a bit weird and you're kind of put off some food. And also before this, I read this study, I thought that we knew in the brain where that connection was, but it actually found out that that is something that was unknown. So basically this new research coming out of Sweden, they did a survey of 25 volunteers where they actually did an MRI on their brain when they gave them some taste and some smell and did mapping of their brain to see that connection. And what they found was it actually is really deep in your brain that you have this connection between flavor and smell, which they did for the first time, which I thought was crazy. So they think that it's not that you taste and then you smell and then it's put together. It's actually in the same part of your brain that's really connected. And so it's kind of giving this new idea to flavor, right? It's really kind of this idea of your brain doing all this really hard work when you're eating or when you're tasting things to do that. And I think it's really kind of nice. You know, I'm interested always in machine learning and AI applications to data. And the way they're able to do this is by using machine learning on these images of the brain. And they didn't just see that, you know, if they tasted something or smelt something, one part lit up, they saw the patterns were exactly the same.
But how do you isolate smell and taste to know which one's which in the brain?
Yeah, so I guess what they did is they had these people that were, well, they were volunteering. They were in an MRI machine and they basically gave them a taste of something and they saw what happened in their brain.
But when you taste something, don't you smell it too?
Oh, that's a good point.
I guess they must have closed off the nose or something.
Closed off their nose, yeah.
Great little test for kids if you want to do a science experiment.
Not allowed to do science on your children.
Yes, you absolutely
only with
are.
Your children.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
I strongly stand by my scientific experiments. Yeah, you get them to get a jelly bean and pinch their nose and then say chew on the jelly bean for 5 seconds, and then and then let go of the nose. And for the first 5 seconds, you cannot taste. It just tastes like sugar. And then when you open your nose, it bursts of lemon or bursts of strawberry because smell is so intertwined with taste. It's such a strong part of our perception of taste. So I was really interested in that. But of course, the anatomy of the mouth, there are, you know, there's taste receptors and so on. But there's, you know, there's also receptors in your nose that are doing something slightly different, it seems.
Yeah, so I guess your taste is really your strong. You know, is it savory? Is it sweet? Is it sour? And they're your taste things, right? But then it's your nose that really gets into the pinpointing of, is it a lemon flavor? Is it a peach flavor? Is it, you know, that's kind of the connection there. And actually going back to the point of how do they not have people smell when they're eating? It's actually that they mapped their brain when they were tasting it. And then they did the same mapping of the brain when they're only smelling it. So it's the connection there of the.
I see. Okay, so it was a minus. They did some subtraction. Yeah, because I was figuring how would they do something like that. Okay, very good. I'm fascinated by this, and I find it really interesting. You know, the idea that someone could be a super taster because they have more papillae on their tongue, and that we used to think that our tongues had all these different areas for tasting.
Yeah, actually, that's not true at all.
No, it's not true at all. And when we taste something, the idea that happens in our brain is kind of so crazy to me. And it means that, you know, theoretically, we could find ways of tasting without a nose or without a mouth. So that's a really interesting story. Our third story has to do, Shane, with superwood. Yeah. What is superwood?
Well, it's a great name, firstly, right? Because everyone's like, superwood. So this is 10 years after the science paper. See, we always, the last story I spoke about, you're like, is anyone actually using this? It took 10 years from the publication of a study in Nature to turn a concept into a commercial idea. And they used wood, and wood is made of cellulose. And cellulose is a very interesting biomaterial. It's the most abundant one in the entire world. And it's really cool because it's how plants are able to stand up without having a skeleton. And when you think about the fact that plants don't have skeletons either internally or externally, that is an amazing thing that they're actually able to stand, right? Yeah. Like trees are huge.
What's also amazing is that cellulose is exactly the same material that you wrap flowers in, that see-through.
Ooh,
like,
that's
how
very
is that
meta.
Possible?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
How is that plant?
Gosh.
Anyway, go on.
So what they did here was they took cellulose and they washed out all of the useless stuff in there that doesn't provide structural integrity. And then they hot pressed it. So they didn't put it in the airing cupboard. They put it into a machine and they squashed it. So they were only using the bits of the cellulose that were strong, and they were freeing up all the empty volume. And in doing that, they were able to make a very, very strong material. That it was 10 times stronger than steel.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was also tough and it was stiff and it did all of the other things that you'd need for a robust material. And 140 patents later, they have been able to scale up the process from, you know, this chemical treatment took a couple of days and you could only do it in small batches. They're now able to do it in a few hours and they're able to do it in big batches. And they've developed a commercial product that you can buy that you might be able to use instead of concrete, instead of steel. And that's really good because, of course, wood and cellulose are abundant and you can grow them and they're sustainable. And concrete is amongst the most carbon intense material that you can think of. So it's an alternative that you could use. They're talking about very boring things at the moment, like the most robust wooden floors. They're like the immediate things they're thinking of. But long term, we might be able to think about building multi-story buildings out of entirely out of wood that would be very robust and more sustainable. Very, very cool. Super wood.
Nice.
Yeah, super.
our final story, Laura, is an interesting one because apparently it is raining on the sun.
Yeah, so this is a story very close to my heart, actually written by colleagues from the University of Hawaii. So rain on the sun is very different to rain on the earth, right? The sun is a big ball of magnetized plasma. The atmosphere of the sun is, you know, filled with this really hot plasma, big magnetic field structures. So big loops that we see if you look in different kind of filters from the visible light that we see with our eyes. And what we see, and we've seen for many years, is this thing called coronal rain. So the atmosphere of the sun is called the corona. And this coronal rain is, if you think of a big kind of loop of the sun, basically things, plasma falling down, and it looks like rain traveling back towards the sun. Usually when we look at the sun, you see things blowing away from the sun.
Yeah.
So rain on the sun, coronal rain. So cooler plasma falling back towards the sun. So if you think of like a lava lamp, you know, when you kind of things moving up and coming back down, it's basically that kind of idea. Now, for years, with really high-resolution observations from telescopes, we have seen this coronal rain, but we haven't been able to theoretically reproduce it. So simulations, anything, we haven't been able to describe it. But now, for the first time, using kind of really interesting new physics and a little bit of chemistry, these authors really looked at producing this, be able to actually explain coronal rain. And it's to do with the chemical makeup of the sun atmosphere, right? So we know the sun is mostly hydrogen and helium, but there's also things like oxygen and silicon. And the ratio of kind of the abundance of that, how much of it is that in relation to each other, is something that we always keep fixed when we do our simulations because we think it doesn't change. But they've showed that they could reproduce this coronal rain by introducing changes in those abundances. And this is really interesting, not just for describing coronal rain, but also our understanding of how the solar atmosphere is energized, and really important for things like space weather, for, you know, how we predict these large eruptions that we see from the sun.
Very cool. If
good
you
band
wanna...
name, right? Coronal rain.
No, only a physicist would think. They're both physicists going, yeah, it's a good name. It's a terrible name. Yeah. Terrible, terrible name.
No, if you thought it, you would have thought it was a good name. So.
Exactly. It is very cool. All right, Laura and Shane, thanks very much. Now, morning sickness. It's miserable. It's very common. But it might just be one of evolution's smartest tricks. What if those waves of nausea in early pregnancy aren't a glitch, but by design? Associate Professor Molly Fox is a biological anthropologist at UCLA. She's been looking into it. She joins us now. Welcome to the program, Molly. I never really thought about it, to be honest. That's the great thing about this program. I often don't think about the questions that we end up asking. What is happening when someone gets morning sickness? When we get pregnant, you'd think that this is a time where everything should be exactly the way it is. Mother Nature doing exactly its job, and yet nausea,
feeling horrible, not being able to sleep sometimes, these really bad symptoms of a pregnancy would, you might think, would be evolutionarily a bad idea. What's going on?
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it's a great question, because I think it's a question a lot of pregnant women ask themselves when they're experiencing these really negative feelings. And evolution, one of the tricky things about evolution is that it hasn't shaped our bodies to be happy and healthy. It's shaped our bodies for the purpose of survival and reproduction. And sometimes that can come with unpleasant feelings. So in the case of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, what we were curious about is whether, even though these are very unpleasant feelings and experiences, they could be serving some kind of function that protects either the mother or the baby while it's developing. Especially because pregnancy is such a vulnerable period, it's very difficult for the mother's body and her defense systems to keep both her and the fetus protected. And the reason for that is because the immune system, which is the body's defense system, evolved to recognize foreign cells in your body and attack them. So what do you do when you have a fetus developing inside of you? Half of the markers on those cells are foreign because they come from the father. And so the immune system is faced with a really difficult challenge here, which is, do I attack these cells or not? And so during pregnancy, the immune system has to really change in major ways, and it has to balance the needs of protecting the mother and the fetus against dangerous infections while not attacking the fetus itself. So it's quite a complicated time of life.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to be, you know, some of these evolutionary psychologists, they kind of just, they run with an idea. So let me run with an idea for a while, right? So if we think about, you know, the possible benefits of morning sickness, being nauseous when you smell certain, you know, spicy foods, that might be your body saying, these could be dangerous to the baby, so don't eat them. You know, people only wanting plain food and so on. But that doesn't happen. A lot of people just get nauseous, you know, without a trigger. Is that the case? Or do they have a trigger that maybe that they're not consciously aware of, but is your body basically saying, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to do this, because it wants to protect that baby? Or is this a side effect of having a baby that goes haywire?
Right. Yeah. And I think it's a good point. So there are two parts of the immune system that we were interested in here. One is the cells of the immune system, which is what we all think of, but there's also the behavioral immune system, which often we don't think of as part of the immune system. But the behavioral immune system also is a way that we protect ourselves, and it's also finely tuned by the process of evolution.
What's the behavioral immune system? I never heard of it.
The behavioral immune system is these very sort of deeply embedded instincts that we have. For instance, you start coughing and you have mucus flowing out of your nose, and I take a step back and I feel like you're gross.
Right. Okay.
That's not
so disgust. Just is a
disgust
behavioral.
The disgust response is actually a finely tuned evolutionary adaptation to help protect us from getting sick by being too close to someone who's showing signs of illness. Or I see some dog poop on the sidewalk and I think it is gross. I think it's gross because my brain has been finely tuned by evolutionary processes to know that feces contains infectious agents. And so we thought that maybe nausea and vomiting in pregnancy may actually have some of these behavioral immune system qualities. So we're really looking at two things in this study. We're looking at whether nausea and vomiting in pregnancy are tied to the actual physical immune system by looking at how they relate to inflammation, and also looking at thinking about the connection between those behavioral traits and the cells of the immune system. So I guess I should really say the connection between the cellular and behavioral immune systems.
So what did you look at in your study, and how did you go about designing it?
So in this study, we had women do questionnaires a little bit later in pregnancy about their full experience of aversions to food or smells, nausea and vomiting during the pregnancy, because those symptoms are typically more severe in early pregnancy when the fetus is in this very critical and vulnerable stage of development.
Yeah.
We also took blood samples at that earlier stage, and then we analyzed those blood samples to look for markers of inflammation.
Okay.
So that was the nature of the study. It was a longitudinal study. We followed the women across pregnancy. And then we looked at the connections between these two. So first, we just looked at how many of the women had nausea and vomiting, food aversions, smell aversions. And our results...
About two-thirds?
Yeah, our results were relatively typical of any population. There wasn't anything particularly unusual about this group of pregnant women. So that was a good sign that, you know, we can kind of continue with our analysis. And then we looked at how they were associated with inflammation and with the kind of structure of inflammation, the type of inflammation that we see. And so we did indeed find that there was an association, for instance, odor aversion or feeling repelled by certain smells, which some but not all pregnant women experience, was associated with more of that inflammatory kind of state. So that more aggressive kind of inflammatory markers. So that could imply that pregnant women who have this aversion to certain smells during pregnancy have a more aggressive and protective immune response during this early phase of pregnancy.
Okay. So triggered by these smells that the body thinks this could be dangerous, there's an increase in the immune response. We see that as inflammation in the blood samples.
Yeah, and what we can't say is which is causing which comes first. Yeah. So we think that it's interesting that these two things seem to be coordinated. Whether the inflammation is causing the nausea or the aversion, I was talking about aversion, but you know, nausea, we had similar findings. So whether it's causing the nausea, the vomiting, or the aversion to smells, that is sort of a next step that we can't prove. But what we can say here is that the two things seem to be happening in sync.
Right. But are the smells that people don't like to smell, are they also potentially harmful? So if we think about the sort of foods or things that could be harmful to a baby, we're talking about, you know, smoke, we're talking about, you know, unpasteurized cheese, raw milk, you know, uncooked food. Is that the sort of, if we look at the mix of foods that you got, your respondents didn't like to smell, or the smell they didn't like to smell, is there a relationship between potential danger and what they didn't like to smell?
Well, it's a good question. And yes, tobacco smoke was the most frequent smell aversion.
Mm, interesting. And even with smokers?
You know, we didn't have enough to women who were smoking during pregnancy. But also for certain protective reasons, we don't tend to ask, did you smoke during the pregnancy? We ask about before the pregnancy. So yes, it was the most frequent one, and it in itself was associated with greater inflammation, aversion to the smell of smoke. But the other odor aversions that were most common were not necessarily tied to something that would be toxic for the mother or the baby. Mm. They were things like body odor or perfumes, which kind of indicates just a, you know, greater sensitivity to smell. Probably those are just the more common smells you encounter. The most frequent food aversion was an aversion to meat. So that could theoretically be because you might imagine.
Yeah, but it's a bit of a jump without the data. Let's talk a little bit about this interesting immune system situation with babies and mothers, right? So because the mothers, they have this baby, as you say, there are now cells that are not them. floating around, does the immune system decide to attack them? That's one thing. But what about the immune system of the baby?
Oh.
Is there been any study to look at the immune system that's developing within the fetus and why it doesn't attack its mother? Because I know, like, as adults, we have our parents, we have like maternal cells floating around in us, right?
Well,
a gift from our mothers still in our bodies. Why do, any ideas as to why the immune system of a fetus doesn't respond?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And there are cells. So the immune system is this system of checks and balances. Most of the immune system is the attacky kind of cells, but some cells suppress inflammation or control it. And so there are these kinds of delicate negotiations that happen between the immune systems of the baby and the mother. So the baby's immune system is, you know, I guess you could describe it as underdeveloped, because a lot of the cells in our immune system, we're not born with them. So we don't have them as a fetus.
Oh, really?
Or even as a little baby. You actually develop a lot of those cells through your encounters in the world. And so,
wow. And I suppose that makes sense in a way, because when we're in the room, we are in a sterile environment. Is that correct? It's that we're first exposed to bacteria and viruses as we exit the womb.
Yeah, it's a relatively sterile environment. There's controversy about whether it's entirely sterile, but I think we can all agree it's either entirely or very close to it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And so some parts of the immune system, some really ancient parts of it, you are born with some ability, so that you pop out of the womb and you're not completely incapable of any self-defense. But a lot of it, it's not just that you haven't encountered viruses and bacteria and other infectious agents. It's also that those vary so much between environments around the world. And so you really do want your immune system to be tailored to your environment.
Right.
So there is some strategy in it.
And that's why I suppose, you know, lactation experts are always saying it's very good to breastfeed, because you're getting exposure to that and at the same time boosting your immune system.
Right. So breast milk contains not just nutrients, but also actually immune agents and components. So that's something that the mother can transmit to the baby, because she is presumably living in the same environment. So again, some sort of evolutionary strategy.
It's awesome. It's so amazing that all of these interconnected systems. I wanted to finish up asking about some of your other work that looks at developmental biology and how experiences may affect the development of fetuses. So we do know that epigenetic change can happen if there's severe trauma that happens to a grandparent, can be passed down right through to a fetus. Is that right? What is your work looking at with Mexican American women, and how is that how is that going?
Oh yeah, sure. So this study was actually conducted in that same population. You know, this particular project that we're talking about, nausea and food aversion, wasn't asking questions about intergenerational trauma, but in that study, we're interested in how both stressors and traumas, as well as resilience factors like family support and relationships, can impact a pregnant woman, because it is the signals that a fetus receives about how to develop all come from within the mother's body. So she lives in this complex world where there's social relationships and political circumstances and viruses and bacteria and, you know, psychological experiences, right? I don't need to tell you what it means to be human. but the baby can't detect anything that isn't translated through biology in the mom's body. So we are looking at how all of the sort of full suite of experiences and exposures a mother has then get translated into these biochemical signals that the fetus can detect, because your DNA code allows for in some cases any number of outcomes. Your DNA code might tell you exactly what eye color you'll have, but it's not going to tell you exactly how tall you're going to be or exactly what kind of brain connections you're going to have or how fast your metabolism is going to be. Those are very flexible traits. And the way that they develop, it depends on signals that you get from your environment. And during pregnancy, that environment is your mom's body.
Yeah. And that makes sense. I suppose we've seen some evidence where populations have experienced famine and the stress of that has been passed on. You can imagine that if someone has a very stressful pregnancy, that the experiences of that, the stress, you know, physical response to stress, translates into some changes in chemistry within the body. Those changes may, of course, affect the baby inside the body.
Right. And, you know, this field of research somewhat started with studies of the not just children, but grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, as this was, you know, one of the most severe traumas that has been documented in human history. And what we see is that in those grandchildren, there are actually traits that have been connected back to the trauma that their grandparents experienced. And so this was one of the impetuses for this field of study to try to see how a trauma experienced by one generation may manifest even multiple generations later.
Really interesting. Associate Professor Molly Fox, a biological anthropologist at UCLA. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I knew we would get comments on this. In fact, we solicited them. And so we're going to read through some of your comments from last week's pod, where we interviewed Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan. She's a physician who specializes in neurology and clinical neurophysiology. We were talking about ADHD and autism. And I should say, before I continue, that we did make a couple of times the point that if a diagnosis works for somebody and it is useful and it helps you in some way, that that is a good thing. But from a societal point of view, over-diagnosing ADHD and over-diagnosing autism is sometimes unhelpful. This is the point that Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan made. Victoria says, I am a parent of two autistic children, one of whom also has ADHD. From her comments, it is clear that Dr. O'Sullivan knows little about the actual diagnostic processes for ADHD and autism. For example, she mentioned that autism was only diagnosed by a psychologist. Autism assessments are in fact carried out by multidisciplinary teams, including an occupational therapist, psychologist, and speech and language therapist, and not a neurologist. She also made no mention of the FDA-approved QB test for ADHD, which objectively measures ADHD symptoms. Therefore, diagnosis is not just up to the opinion of one psychologist, as she suggested. So before I continue, that Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan operates in the UK, and she made comments about speaking to a psychologist. It was that what she was talking about with the results of an interview that she had with a psychologist. I'm not sure obviously that was an individual case and an individual psychologist, but in that specific case, she was speaking to the psychologist. Overall, the conversation gave the impression that being autistic is something that might hold a person back and is something of which they should be ashamed. I don't know if I can agree with that, but I appreciate your opinion. I can assure you that it's exhausting constantly advocating for my children, although they are flourishing with the classroom supports that an autism diagnosis provides the roadmap for, such as movement breaks and visual timetables. I absolutely agree that any child that needs assistance in any way should get the assistance they need, regardless of a diagnosis, to be honest. But I was trying, certainly as the interviewer in that particular case, to be very careful not to in any way stigmatize having ADHD, autism, or say that any of these people who live with a condition like this are in some way being held back or that they should be ashamed of it. That absolutely is not what we intended to do, and it was something I was very conscious in the interview. So I'm going to, my own position is to say I don't have that point of view, having taken the interview, but I understand how hearing that conversation might be upsetting, depending on your point of view. Someone else says,
And that someone else's name is Aisling. Thank you for your recent episode featuring Dr. Susanna Sullivan. She raises important questions about whether we can support people without medical diagnoses. Interestingly, Irish policy claims to do this exactly through needs-led services. However, for people with neurodevelopmental conditions like ASD, autism spectrum disorder, and ADHD, and their families navigating Ireland's support pathways, their lived experience tells a different story. Until Ireland genuinely delivers on its promise of needs-led services, questioning whether people really need diagnoses risks removing people's only pathway to support. Absolutely fully agree with that. I totally understand why, for many people, in terms of knocking down a door to get help for their child, these diagnoses are the only path. In that case, whether or not... Whether or not the condition has a name, if it unlocks pathway to support, absolutely think that's a wonderful thing. It is a stain on this and previous governments that we have not been able to find and deliver what we need to do when it comes to children in classrooms and in society. The conversation about appropriate diagnosis matters, however. It must be grounded in the reality that Ireland is trapped between two systems, legally needs-led, but practically diagnosis-led. Fully agree. The concern about resources being stretched too thin is understandable, particularly when considering people with the highest support needs. Yet this assumes a zero-sum game. The real issue isn't that too many people are accessing support. It's that Ireland provides insufficient support for anyone. Rather than questioning who deserves help, perhaps we should be asking why a wealthy nation chooses not to adequately fund comprehensive support for all citizens. Absolutely. Perhaps the question worth exploring isn't simply, are we diagnosing too many people, but rather, how do we build systems robust and inclusive enough to support people based on actual need while continuing to refine our understanding of individual people's needs? Thank you for creating space for these nuanced discussions. Enjoyed Future Proof for many years and appreciate the comments. I fully concede all those points. While it is a much bigger apple to take a bite out of, it is a much more valuable question to be asking. Thanks for those. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo de Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.